Hightown are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Well, we're very familiar with wildfires here in Colorado, and the Four Mile Canyon fire's anniversary is coming up. In 2008, the Tassajara, the oldest Zen Buddhist monastery in the United States, was threatened by a wildfire that was struck by two lightnings. The monks and students were told to evacuate, but five monks returned to protect the campus. Colleen Martin Bush took part in classes at the monastery and interviewed and documented the story of fighting the fire. Welcome, Colleen.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Good morning. Welcome. Let's say.
Good morning.
There you are. And Colleen, these were your friends. And so did it make harder to be objective and write a fair account of the fire?
You know, I guess the quick answer is no, I don't feel like it did. I was aware of that potential possibility. First of all, I didn't know them that well at the start of the book project. I just knew them by name. And I, of course, got to know them over the course of it. So that was one factor. But I felt like I could hold both. I could take advantage of the fact that I had close access and was getting to know them and still maintain enough objectivity to get the facts right and get the story right. I just sort of felt like I was juggling both of those roles.
And it's funny, you know, as you heard, I said in the intro that we experience way too much fire here in Colorado. And I thought I'd be thinking about, you know, the fires we've had lately. And I live in the foothills also and have experienced fires near me, not fortunately close enough that I ever had to evacuate. Mm-hmm. But the thing about funny reading this story, it kept reminding me of Mount St. Helens eruption.
Oh, really?
And 57 people died in that. And, you know, a few of them refused to leave. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering of your insight of why these people decided to protect all the material things on the campus.
Yeah. Because they thought they could do it safely. They had weeks to prepare, and they had really great systems in place. They had an irrigation system from one end of the grounds to the other on the rooftops that they had built themselves that they called Dharma Rain.
Explain Dharma Rain.
Dharma Rain is PVC pipe and sprinklers, you know, garden supplies.
But very nice name.
But yeah, one of the monks dubbed it Dharma Rain, and it really stuck, obviously. But, you know, they were prepared, and they knew that landscape intimately. They knew Tassajara intimately, so that they felt really in their guts that they could stay and do it safely, which is why they turned around. So not to say that it couldn't have gone not as good as it did. But when they made that decision to stay, they felt they were doing it with their own safety also in mind.
And one of the characters I liked, people you met, I really like Stuart. He did have Buddhism background, but he was also a professional firefighter.
That's right. Yeah, he's like an old, longtime friend of Tassajara. He's been going down there for years to do first aid trainings. You know, doesn't I think strictly practice Zen anymore, but had that background. And he was in a really tough position because he was down there advising them, but with no actual authority. So here he was, the expert, and making advice, but they did not have to follow his advice. There was no, you know, official line of duty there.
One of the things that I don't like about our world is people find ways to be prejudiced. Mm. You start your story with giving background of all these people, and they come across as your basic American Europeans who have lives and different skills. Mm. And near the end of it, you refer to them mostly as priests. Was there prejudice in Northern California, and do you find prejudice plays them out in where they were not helped?
There's that idea out there. Certainly someone put that forth, that if this had been a Civil War monument, you know, that the firefighters would have been flocking to help them. I mean, they did help them leading up to the fire. It was just that they were not willing to put a professional crew down there during the fire because there's one road in and out, and that presented a safety issue for them that they couldn't surmount. But, you know, so I don't know the answer to that because, of course, no one's ever copped to that. But I guess it's out there floating around that they weren't helped because they were Buddhist. But they're not stuck on that. They've moved on in there. They made the decision they made and took responsibility for it.
Talk about their personalities. One of the things I mentioned, the Four Mile Canyon fire, and what the Boulder residents did was they had a store here where residents donated furniture. So people that lost everything could come and pick out things to wherever they ended up living in a rental agency or whatever. And when I was in that store, some of the folks just walked around in a daze because they had lost everything. Mm-hmm. What does the Buddhist background give from a person who's got a, what would I call, modern religion? background?
Yeah. Wait, can you...
How is the difference in approaching, you know, life's heavy,
tragedies.
You know, tragedies?
Yeah.
And do you feel that the Buddhist background really, really played a large part?
I do. I think, you know, the main teaching that is at play in this story, too, is that, you know, life is suffering and there's no way around that. And so Buddhist practice basically teaches you to work with that. You can't get rid of it. So what do? Instead, you just work with it. You practice with it. Whatever comes your way, you know, whether it's a wildfire or a job loss, a loss of a loved one, you meet that as best you can and try to engage with it rather than turning away from it, because there's no way out. You know, there's no way away from life's suffering. So Buddhism does not try to deny that a lot of really difficult things happen for people. They do. That's a fact of life. So can you actually just turn toward them and find your life in those, right in those difficulties, right there in that mess of, if you've lost all your belongings, there's your life.
And even the monks, many of the monks had come from some kind of tragedy in their life, and that's what brought them towards this.
Yeah, I think a lot of people turn toward practice because they see the suffering in their own lives. They know it's there, and so it resonates for them. It's like, okay, it's here. It keeps showing up. How do I live with this?
Tassajara was at the end of a 7-mile road. A lot
14.
Of, 14 miles?
14 miles of dirt.
Wow. Okay. I didn't realize it was 14
yeah,
miles.
Twice that.
For our audience, it looked a lot like the road that goes up Moffat Tunnel. It's a windy road on a ridge, and
right.
You can drive off the ridge. In fact, at one point, when they were told to evacuate, the fire was below the ridge.
Right, exactly.
And is it an escapism, or how do they use the monastery versus interacting with the real world?
Okay. Yeah, I think the thing about that setting is, you know, yes, it's in a remote area because you can kind of then get away from a lot of the things, a lot of the noise of our modern world, a lot of the things that distract us and preoccupy us. But at the same time, you're remote with others. You're never alone there. I mean, when you go to Tassajara, you have a community. It's like you've gone on a backpacking trip with anywhere from, you know, 50 to 150 people. That's their max capacity. In the summer is 150. So you're remote. And you're remote with others, and you're constantly practicing what that's like to be down there in that deep canyon with other people in a community. So, and people are not expected to stay there. They're actually expected to go up the road and go back into the world at some point and share that practice, by embodying what they've learned, basically.
So there was one woman who stayed. Tell us about Mako?
Mako.
Mako. Thank you.
Mako was the head cook. I was really glad she was in this story. Being a woman myself, I think I was happy there was a woman character, you know, for lack of a better word. She's a real person, not a character. But she was the head cook at the time, and this actually presented some problems for her because, here she was in the kitchen when they were out there digging fire line, and she struggled a little bit with that, even though Zen teaches that whatever the work is that you're doing, it's not higher or lower than some other job. And clearly they needed to eat, so it was very important work. But she talks about in the book, I think in a very human way, her struggles with that, with wanting to be out there getting dirty and digging fire line, which eventually she was out there getting dirty.
And it almost seems, even though she had accepted the Buddhist world, she was still coming up across glass ceilings?
Well, yeah, basically, yeah. She's very frank, and so she shares with me feeling like maybe the abbot was coddling her at some point. The abbot is a much older man, and maybe he was seeing her as one of his daughters. And she speaks to that, you know, and speaks very frankly in a way that I think is encouraging, you know, acknowledging that is there.
And at one point she was in charge of fire safety at the...
That's right. She was a fire marshal. They have a resident fire crew that's always there. So they always prepared for fire at Tassajara at some level, something not as big as this, but they're prepared to meet fire. And she had a lot of training. And when she did that job, she kind of revamped it and took it on really completely. So that's the reason she was one of the people to turn around and go back, was because of that experience she'd had.
Now, they were given 3 weeks to prepare as the fires burned around them. But to give a picture, at one point they were very thirsty, but she tells them that the Gatorade is burning.
Right. It's, you know, one of them, I tried to find humor where I could in the story and introduce it, you know, to balance the seriousness of the situation. And there is a scene in the book where Mako is way down at one end of Tassajara alone. They're in radio contact, and somebody makes a call for Gatorade, who's at another part of Tassajara. And she answers back, the Gatorade's on fire. And they think she's joking. I mean, what are you talking about? But a whole case of Gatorade, the plastic bottles were actually burning. They were on fire. She was not kidding. And she put it out, and then she was thirsty, so she grabbed a bottle that had not been compromised and opened it up and decided to drink some Gatorade.
And it's just kind of a picture to think plastic bottles could actually burn.
Exactly.
Her.
Yeah.
So what about the Buddhism world? You're a journalist. You kind of going back to both worlds. How did these people react to the Cal Fire and the National Park Service?
How did the people at Tassajara react?
Yeah, I guess you always think of Buddhists mellow, but they did have to fight for their lives.
Yeah, you know, they I think had good relationships with people, and they tried to have good relationships with people. The problem is some of the people in the fire command did not want to relate back. They just wanted to give orders. We need you to evacuate because that's what we need. But that wasn't what Tassajara needed. So it did bring them into conflict, but there was never any animosity, I don't think. I mean, that's one thing that Buddhist practice, I think, instills is a respect for basically relationships. Everything is relationships. How do you relate to your own thoughts first and your own body when it's in pain, when you're meditating? How do you relate to the people around you? How do you relate to the environment that you live in? So this is constant practice. So even when there were difficulties, they were working with them.
Even though, like, I think at one point you say they did, the National Forest Service did protect the Boy Scout camp, but did anybody actually stay at the Boy Scout camp?
No, well, they sent crews in. Yeah, there were crews there. I think maybe one, at least one engine. But at Tassajara, they were clear from the very beginning there would not be. It was a story that never deviated. We will not be sending a crew down there for you during the fire. They hoped, however, that that would change because in 1977 and in 1999, when big fires went through Tassajara, there was robust support on the ground. Many, many engines, firefighters that were prepared to stay days. But story, you know, times have changed. There's more safety awareness now. And so the firefighters were taken care of. You know, they didn't want to put their own people in danger, which is also understandable.
So Tassajara has had three major fires in 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
What's the pull to stay there? And would they ever think about moving anywhere else?
The pull to stay there, I think, is if you've been there, it's, you know, it's just a mesmerizing place. It's so beguilingly beautiful and wild. And so to think of moving, I think, is difficult. However, if Tassajara had burned, I think maybe they would have entertained the thought, do we want to rebuild here again? But it didn't. It didn't burn down. So they're there for now, and they know they need to live with fire, that fire is part of that landscape. It's going to be a friend.
Is it a place that actually introduces people to the Buddhism world?
Absolutely, because people go down there in the summer, like right now it's the summer season, and people will go down attracted to the environment, you know, the natural surroundings, the hot springs, the gourmet vegetarian food, which has been somewhat internationally made famous by several cookbooks, the Tassajara Bread Book and Tassajara Cooking, which have been around since the early 70s, I think. So people know about it. They come down just for that. And then maybe they take something away that makes them piques their curiosity about Buddhism, or maybe they don't. But they simply, just by being in that atmosphere, you know, absorb something of the way of being there, which is respectful, calm, flexible.
So many people go there more for the environment than the meditation.
Yeah, it's not very far from a lot of, you know, urban places. It's not far from the Bay Area. It's a 4-hour drive. So in 4 hours, you can feel as if you're really out there in the wilds, and yet you still have some of the creature comforts. I mean, there's kerosene lanterns in the guest cabins. There's no electricity in the guest cabins. So you are forced to slow down just by that. And there's like two phone lines that the guests can use that they're sharing among maybe 80 guests. So you have to slow down from your normal way of being, and it's fairly accessible.
And it's rural, and you just said kerosene lamps, but also solar panels.
Yeah, in fact, now they're 100% solar. When the fire went through, it wasn't quite 100%, but now it's 100%. They're generating all their own power right now. So that's really, they're really happy about that.
Are the bathrooms just pit toilets?
No, they flush.
They flush.
They flush. So I had to think for a second.
There's modern plumbing there.
Yes, there's modern plumbing. Although I don't know about modern. It's, I think, a little creaky.
Were you aware of all the different buildings? Like, for example, is it the birdhouse? The penthouse?
The birdhouse. Yes.
The birdhouse.
Yeah.
Explain that. Is that Is that a honeymoon suite?
No, in fact, guests can't stay there. It's a student cabin. So there are student cabins and guest cabins. And of course, during the monastic periods, when they're just practicing there and the gate is closed and the public's not coming, they occupy more of the grounds. But in the summer, there's most of the grounds are guest cabins. And then the student cabins are kind of on the periphery. And the birdhouse is a student cabin, which is up on a very steep hill, one of the hills that the fire came over. It's called the birdhouse because it's kind of perched right sort of looking like it's in the arms of an old oak tree. And that cabin, they actually did lose during the fire, but they've rebuilt it.
But they didn't lose the oak tree.
They did not lose the oak tree, though. Every time I've been back, they're losing bits of the oak tree. It's okay. Compromised. It's definitely pieces of it are falling off, pieces of it that were damaged. And apparently it's still alive. It's a heritage oak. It's more than 100 years old. But I don't know that it's always going to be there. It seems like it's hanging on for dear life.
Oh, hanging on for dear life.
Yeah.
How is Tassajara? That's not hanging on for dear life.
No, Tassajara is completely, only buildings on the periphery were lost. And even right after the fire, it was kind of an oasis of green in a very burned landscape all around it. And then pretty soon, actually within 3 weeks, ferns were sprouting up, grasses were sprouting back up, the chaparral was resprouting from the roots, and the wildflowers the spring afterward, you probably know that from the fires here, were phenomenal. So regeneration happened pretty much immediately.
What significance does bocce have in the Buddhism religion?
Bocce ball? No significance other than the fact that it was a very good place to safely bury the Buddha during the fire, the Buddha statue that they have, which is 2,000 years old. It's there because Tassajara used to be a resort. Before Zen Center bought it, it was a resort. People from Big Sur area and the Watsonville area near Santa Cruz would come down just to soak in the hot springs in the early 1900s. So that's the bocce ball courts. Genesis is from that time.
Was the Buddha buried there through all three fires?
No. In fact, in the 77 fire, I think they took it out. But then shortly after that fire, there was actually a structure fire in the Zendo the following spring. And the Buddha toppled from the altar and broke into several pieces and had to be restored by an art restorer very delicately, so that now you actually, when you look at it, can barely see that there's any damage. So that's why they're so careful now, because they've had that experience of it breaking.
It's the most, it was the most cherished piece of equipment there.
Equipment.
Can you explain what was the symbolic? Yes.
It's cherished because first of all, it's an antique. It's like 2,000 years old, from this Gandharan region, of Afghanistan and Pakistan. It's some of the oldest images of the Buddha were made there. So they take care of it. That said, it's, in Buddhism, even if the Buddha statue were to disintegrate in the flames, that would be okay. I mean, you would accept that if that happened. They would have accepted that if Tassajara had gone up in flames. And I often get asked, but isn't that attachment? Don't Buddhists try to practice being not attached to material things? Yes, that's true, but that doesn't mean you don't, when you have a 2,000-year-old Buddha statue to take care of, that you don't find a way to try to protect it. It's not, letting things deliberately burn or go to waste,
So what is the symbolism involved in where they actually have a ceremony and they close its eyes and then they had to open its eyes and explain it?
Yeah, when they put a statue on the altar, there's an eye opening ceremony to put it on and an eye closing ceremony when you take it off. It's just a traditional thing to do. It's actually a really lovely, short little ceremony. And they actually found time to do this when they were evacuating Tassajara, because they all did evacuate before five people turned around and came back. And they found the time to put the Buddha in a pre-dug hole in the bocce ball court and to do a very quick impromptu, maybe minute-long eye-closing ceremony to sort of put the Buddha to sleep, thinking that they were leaving and that he was going to be the only one there to see what happened to Tassajara. But of course, things changed and five people came back. But they didn't unbury the Buddha right away.
Because the fire continued for weeks?
Yeah, the fire came through actually 18 hours later was the main fire front, and it came through very dramatically. And then it passed through, as most fire fronts do. But then for weeks, they had to patrol because there were still smoldering things. The birdhouse structure, in fact, that I mentioned that burned down, that was on the day the fire arrived. I think it was 11 to 13 days later, it burst into flame again. The ruins of it burst into flame again because the fire had traveled along, it was still in the roots. It was still underground of the tree. And basically the structure caught fire again. And there were other fires like that where fire had smoldered underground or smoldered in the duff. and things would ignite. So they had to be vigilant for a number of weeks after the main fire front.
Yeah, in fact, I'm losing my words. Peat moss pit, the pit for all the for the garden,
The compost,
compost.
Yeah,
that kept
catching fire because compost is hot. If it's actually working, right, you want compost to be hot. So they actually had to replace that whole structure. But yeah, there were structures all over the grounds that were, because of the way Tassajara is situated at the bottom of a very deep canyon with steep hills on either side, rolling debris could easily catch anything. So they were on guard.
I'm talking to Colleen Martin Bush, and she's written a book about called Fire Monk, and it's about Tassajara, which is the oldest Buddhist monastery.
Oldest Zen Buddhist monastery in the United States.
In the United States. Mm-hmm. Your experience of writing this book.
Mm-hmm.
How was it? How long did it take?
It took...
The fire was 2008.
Yeah.
The book is out now.
Yeah. I mean, the writing phase, the research phase, all of that was a couple of years, solid. Just that was all I was doing. And, you know, first it was just trying to get this story because I was not on the ground there with them during the fire. So I had to do many, many interviews with many people to put it together. And people were in different places during the fire, too. So it was like putting together this elaborate, huge jigsaw puzzle. And I wanted to do it in a way where the book would read as if you were there with them, which meant I had to gather a lot of very minute detail. You know, what was actually served that day for lunch? What was the weather forecast doing? What were the winds doing? Things like that. So a lot of research. And then once I had all that material, then it was just sitting down and putting it together.
What were the quotes at the beginning of each chapter that you used to signify?
I think to set a mood for the chapter. There are a variety of quotes from a variety of sources. Some of them are from the fire books that I was reading, which I read lots of fire books, and lots of adventure books, so that I could study how pacing, you know, happens in a story like that, what pulls you through. But a lot of them are also Buddhist quotes, so it's a mix, and I think I'd say I was trying to set up, to put you sort of like a prologue to the chapter, to bring up a certain mood.
You really do describe fire in detail and how it can be an explosion or a tornado.
Mm-hmm.
What do you hope most that people will take away from this book?
You know, it's about fire, but it's really about inner fires as much as it is about outer fire. And that's what I think the general reader can take away. I mean, you could take a lot away from the book, but overall, it's really about adversity and how you can't control what comes to you in your life. You can't control what it is you have to deal with, but you can work on your own relationship to whatever it is that you have to meet in your life. And that's within your power to do that.
And the five fire monks and how their resolve to save the monastery comes through in that, and that's what you hope
yes,
for?
Yes, I think there's a calmness that they embodied, a clarity of mind, you know, not getting caught up in their fears, which is fear is basically about the future. You know, if you're actually present in the present moment, you're usually not fearful. You're present. So not running away with fear or anxiety or needing to know exactly how things were going to go, because this was a wildfire. It was changing moment by moment. So all of those qualities, I think, are very good tools for dealing with life.
And how is Tassajara involved in your life now, Colleen?
Tassajara is still very involved in my life. I just went down actually for the launch of the book. It was great to be there again. And I'm actually planning on doing a period of intense practice there in the near future where I'll go for 3 months and I'll be putting on robes and sitting facing a wall for a lot of the day and working for a lot of the day. So
have the five monks read the book?
Yes, they have. Yeah, they actually helped me, you know, make sure I had my facts right early on. And they're quite happy to see it now in its finished form. It's quite gratifying, I think, to see it all. The work and the work that they did in this form where it can be shared with people.
Warts and all.
Warts and all. Yep, exactly. Yeah, these are people.
We've been speaking with Colleen Martin Bush, who wrote Fire Monks, and thanks for dropping in today.
Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Tune in to KGNU for two very special live broadcasts from Planet Bluegrass's Rocky Grass Festival. Let KGNU bring you backstage for this sold-out festival and listen to highlights from Friday and Saturday nights as well as live performances from the festival stage. KGNU's live coverage from Rocky Grass will air Saturday, July 30th and Sunday, July 31st from 9 a.m. until 1 p.m. So tune in this weekend to Rocky Grass only on KGNU.
It's 9 o'clock. You're listening to KGNU Boulder, Denver, 88.5 FM and 1390 AM. Well, we've all heard the story about Yukari's incident with the TSA, and this week, Shelley Schlender got to sit down with Yukari and got a first-person account of the event. Here's that interview now.
You're tuned to KGNU. I'm Shelley Schlender. Many people worry about the growing list of security measures that U.S. air travelers must submit to before they board a plane. One of those with concerns is KGNU volunteer Yukari Miyamai. Earlier this July, Yukari was arrested over a dispute about screening that happened at the Phoenix airport. It was her first arrest ever. Her arrest touched a nerve about increasingly demanding airport screening techniques, and soon her case was making headlines around the world. While Yukari has avoided speaking directly with the press, this week Yukari decided to share what happened. Up next, here's Yukari.
I have been going to commute to Phoenix for many weeks now. I started this job in May, and I have been subject to aggressive pat-down a few times.
When you say an aggressive pat-down, what do you mean?
Grabbing my breast, grabbing all my sore, sensitive area from my side to my front of my body to inside of my thigh, from top to bottom. I just suffer so much from being subject to pat-down.
This is a pat-down that you've gone through
previously.
Even if you've gone through the scanning machine, or is this because you would rather not go through the Phoenix Airport scanning machine?
I went through the X-ray scanner machine because I was told that I would not get pat-downs, but then I got pat-down anyway. Whether you go to the X-ray, whether you go to the metal detector, if you are chosen, you will be getting pat-down. And what triggered the choice by the TSA agent seems to be very random to me.
It sounds like you had observed that they were patting you down a lot more than most travelers get patted down, and it doesn't feel comfortable to have a stranger touching you.
Right. So I arrived on the Phoenix airport on July 14th. While I was putting my luggage and everything in a box to be scanned, I saw someone walk through the metal detector gate without getting pat down. By the time when my turn came, I requested that I too walk through the metal detector gate. And I was told that gate is now closed and I have no choice. I was asking questions why that is, you know, why suddenly this gate was closed, and why cannot I go through the metal detector? And that became debate and argument.
Were you feeling fed up?
Well, I just did not understand their logic. The metal detector gate is used anywhere. If you go to the courthouse, you have to go through the metal detector gate. Internationally, I go through the metal detector gate, and suddenly this option is closed off to me. I did not understand.
You've said that you don't like the radiation exposure.
I have lots of concern about the radiation because dental x-rays, mammograms, we do get lots of exposure. I do have a concern for my thyroid. So my choice and preference towards the metal gate has become more important to me.
Have you been more and more suspicious of the rhyme and reason of how people get chosen for which kind of gate they go through?
Especially with the Phoenix airport, I feel I'm targeted. I go through the airport every week.
This is for your job, where you're commuting there as a translator.
Yes.
When you're in Europe, do you get patted down so much? Do you get told to go through the higher security screening gates?
No, I never had any pat down. I just went through the metal gate. Stockholm, I flew in and out, very civilized.
In Stockholm, at the airport, do you have to take off your shoes?
I don't think so. I don't remember taking shoes off in any other airport than the United States.
Do you have to stand in a screening booth where you have to spread your legs and put your arms over your head?
No.
Do they require pat-downs?
No, not at all. I didn't see anybody who is prepared to pat me down in Europe, even in England, in London. I didn't get any oppressive treatment. Sometimes they ask you very probing questions. But it is very intelligent conversations. They look you in eyes. In the airport here in the United States, I feel I'm treated like animals or things, not a person. So when they give you the choice of which gate I should go, I have no voice. If I voice my preference, it is upsetting to the system.
And the warning flags go up.
Probably.
Since you know what it's like to go through an airport where you don't get patted down, and then here in the United States, you've been through some airports where you have to go there for your work, you have to brace yourself for what the screening techniques might be, how does that make you feel when you go through those screening methods in the United States?
I dread every time I have to do this trip.
When you go to Phoenix, you dread it especially there?
Yes. Very, very scary. I just dread to go to Phoenix.
Before you got arrested, you were just quietly dreading the fact that you were going through this airport where there is such a high likelihood that you were going to have to go through the scanner that you don't like.
Yes.
Were you hoping that maybe this time you could go through the scanning device that didn't have as much x-ray exposure? You were hoping that you wouldn't have to be patted down again.
Yeah.
You had just seen somebody who got to go through the metal detector gate and didn't get patted down.
Right.
And then what happened to you?
I was told the gate is suddenly closed.
You were really hoping that you could go through that metal detector gate.
I know. I actually said, I want that gate. I want that gate. And they said, you have no choice. You have no choice.
All right. So when you finally took your quiet dread and made a point of speaking up about it, did you get very expressive in what you were saying?
I just said, I want this gate. I want to go through this gate.
And then what did they say back to you?
Only I hear was, I have no choice. And then the whole message of, I have no choice, was triggering my panic.
When you say panic, how are you breathing?
Oh, I cannot remember all the details. I was in this space of desperation. My vision, the peripheral vision, was shrinking. I see all these people surrounding me, including police officers with guns. All these people look taller than me.
How tall are you?
5 feet.
You're 5'0".
Yes. Actually, I may have shrunk a little.
Do you remember how many people there were who suddenly surrounded you?
Oh, I cannot remember. At least several of them, if it's not more. I felt the fear. I felt fear of being molested by these people.
Did they respond by moving back when you felt fearful like that, or did they move in?
Move in. Closer. This tall woman, TSA officer, was called in. Her job was to describe how the system works. And when she said, let me show you how it's done.
Did she mean a pat down?
I do not know, but to me, it was something to do with patting down.
So your mind was going, not another pat down.
Yeah.
And not with so many people surrounding you and penning you in.
Yes, I felt cornered.
And then what happened?
I went like this.
You just moved your hand in a pushing motion, you know, pushing back.
But with like this.
Okay, describe your hand.
I don't know how to describe this. Is it clawing?
Yes, you have your fingers bent as the way that you're pushing back so that not even the palm of your hand would be touching. It's more that your fingers are pushing.
I did this. I pushed it like this. And then she said, you touch me. You touched me. You cannot touch me. That's what she said.
Okay, so let's stand back for a second and describe this situation again just so we picture it. You're 5 feet tall. The other woman who was facing you is tall, if it was somebody your size, your hand would have landed on their shoulder. But she's taller than you, and so your hand landed on her breast, perhaps.
Yes, perhaps.
Do you really know where your hand landed?
No, this was such an instinct moment to just want to keep my space, my personal space, from this oppressive presence.
The other thing I'm trying to picture is how close was this woman to you, the TSA agent? Because the way that you're pushing, I don't think that that person could have been any more than 2 feet away from you. Maybe even less, like a foot away.
Yes, she was close.
Are you comfortable with people that close to you?
No. I have a sense of boundary. I do not want the stranger too close to me.
So you were panicked. Here were people who were in your personal space. Did you feel safe or did you feel really in danger or what?
I felt fear. I felt I was invaded. I felt I have no choice.
Did you feel angry? Was it more defiant? Did you feel take that or was it fear?
Fear. I didn't mean to do any harm. I didn't have any intention of anything other than keeping this person away from my space.
All right, so that's slowing down that moment of your choice and decision there. And then the response from this agent who touches and pats people down all the time was to say, "You touched me."
She said, "You touched me. You touched me. You cannot touch me." And I said, "You people always touch me and touch many people." But she said, "I didn't touch you. You touched me." And then the police officer standing by on my left, he suggested to TSA officer, "Would you like to charge her for sexual assault?" And the TSA woman hesitated. And the police officer again suggested, "Would you like to charge her for sexual assault?" And she said yes. And then immediately I was arrested.
What is the difference between touching somebody and violating their personal space and sexual assault?
I'm just telling you my story here. I do not know the details of legal definitions, but I know that the police officer should have known the implication, how serious this particular charge is.
Touching and violating personal space seems more like a misdemeanor and does not have a sexual attack intention to it. Sexual assault is intentional sexual assault. That's my guess. And also, it's a felony offense. Did any of that register with you as you heard this?
You know, things happened really fast because as soon as police officer suggested to charge me with this accusation, and then this TSA officer said yes, I was immediately detained. I was handcuffed. All my belongings was taken away. And then I was put into the jail inside of the airport. I was hysterical. I was crying.
Are you someone who normally pushes people away?
Well, people usually don't come near me that close.
Okay, so since people don't normally come close to you and surround you and circle you, you haven't had that much experience with seeing how you respond when that happens. In fact, has that ever happened in your life to be surrounded like that?
When I was a kid, I was surrounded by the gang of boys. I escaped.
By pushing them away?
No, I was just running away. I was running away, but the surrounded experience I have, and then I also have been abducted when I was a kid and was kept captive for at least a few hours, if it's not several hours. I was 7 years old. At the time, I know my mom, my mother have called police to look for me. I somehow ran away from this captivity. So I have a very strong sense of endangerment. I have a high alert system for my safety.
And here was a situation where supposedly the effort in the airport was to help you be a safe traveler, and instead it scared the willies out of you.
Terrorizing me. They have terrorized me.
All right, so Yukari Miyama, you'd been scared. You'd been surrounded, and you'd had experiences in your past, which led you to believe that when you're surrounded like that, you might get hurt. And you pushed back and said, get out of my space. You didn't say that, but with your gestures, you were hoping to say that. You're short. The TSA agent is taller. And so where your pushback happened was not her shoulder, it was on her breast. And then the police officer said, let's call this sexual assault. And the TSA agent said, yes, let's. And within a few minutes, you're in the Phoenix airport jail, crying.
From the airport jail, I had only very short chance of calling someone. Because of my state of mind, I couldn't remember any of my telephone number that I need to call. And the only telephone number I can even remember is 303-449-4885.
Well, all of our pledge drives have made a difference. Saying that number over and over again during a pledge drive means it's in your mind.
So I called KGNU to let people know that I'm being arrested and I do not know what's going to happen, but I want you to know. That was such a blessing to know that someone knows what happened to me.
That someone knows what happened to you.
Because many people may go to jail without nobody know what happened to them.
All right, let's get back to the jail. Now you've been, what's it called, booked?
Yes, there's a mini process of fingerprinting and the famous mugshot.
You look pretty good in all those.
Oh my God, I don't think so.
And all those photographs that have been all over the internet.
Oh, that's horrible. They want you to look bad, basically. I have witnessed the photographer of this mugshot telling other prisoner to look tough. For my turn, I was so afraid, but I just wanted to look better. So I tried to smile. So they take second one. And then they said, that's better.
Maybe you didn't smile as much in the second picture. All right, so you've been booked. You've had your photo taken, and now you get to be in the jail.
Oh, one thing I forgot to tell you, in airport jail, I also got patted down. The woman officer grabbed my breast from the back. She patted all my body down.
After all of this, where you really did not want to pat down?
I screamed. Actually, I said, I don't want to be touched. I don't want to be touched. And they did it anyway. And then in this 4th Avenue jail, I was also patted down by male officer from my breast to back. But he was whispering to me, I'm so sorry.
Did that help to have him apologizing for invading your space?
Yes.
So that human touch of somebody saying, I'd rather not do this, but we need to do this right now. Does that make a difference?
Yes.
Normally, you're a dignified and polite person who is soft-spoken. It's not common for you to be yelling and crying. That's not how you
normally are. I said, I want to go home. I want to go home.
Probably in not that calm a voice either.
Well, actually, I heard other people shouting from other cells saying, I want to go home. I want to go home. And people crying out. The prison employees communicated to me. They couldn't believe that I'm in their custody.
Why could they look at you and think, wait a second, this isn't our normal jailbird here? Is it because you're an educated person? Is it because of how you were dressed that day? What do you think it was?
I think the charge was so unthinkable.
The charge that you had sexually assaulted a Transportation Safety Administration officer in the airport seemed unbelievable to them?
I have overhearing them talking, it's like, oh my God, I can't believe this. And then even judge told me that he cannot see anything sexual about this.
Now, the charge of sexual assault against a TSA agent, that felony charge has been dismissed and was dismissed promptly.
Immediately.
when you spoke with the judge, there were no limitations placed on your travel.
No, not at all.
How did that feel to have the judge treating you that way?
I said, finally, reasonable person in Arizona. That's how I felt at the time.
After you talked with the judge to get back to Denver, you had to go back through the airport.
I got patted down again. You know, I have involuntary reaction to pat down. My body scream, voice will come. And then I... like this.
You grimace and all of your muscles tense up.
Yes, I cannot tolerate stranger touching me.
As a TSA agent, do you think they have the training to tell the difference between somebody who is maybe being upset because they're hiding a weapon and somebody who's upset because they have some trauma in their experience or their personal boundary space is such that this is very, very intimidating to be touched? Do you think that they know how to distinguish between those two?
Oh, I don't think they have capacity to feel any other people's feelings because they themselves are suppressed to do this job that I'm sure they don't particularly enjoy.
Do you have an issue with any of the TSA agents?
Not as a people. I have a problem with the process design that they came up with. You know, American people are creative people. They can come up with something else.
Do you think that there are other airport travelers who also have either past experiences or just a body sense that leads them to feel extra dread for being patted down?
Well, there is an organization. I cannot remember exact name. I'm so sorry. Their website is Free to Fly or something like that. They told me they support with all their capacity to help me get through this.
How did that feel to have them reach out to you?
I was very touched because there are so many media outlets calling me and requesting an interview. I feel very intimidated by the way they focus on groping and breast and those kind of issue.
Well, let's go back and look at that. There were a lot of headlines about your arrest. They were very catchy headlines, such as Airport Traveler Gropes Back. And then there was another one that said, tit for tat, airport traveler gropes back at TSA agent. I gather that in the police report, they had used words that did make it sound like an intentional grabbing and pushing. Mm-hmm. Reading the responses of people to that police report, they were often describing how they sometimes have wished they could say, you're going to touch me? Well, take that, I'm going to touch you. There have been responses about the young man who said, don't touch my junk. There's something about the fact that there's so many pat-downs that is striking a raw nerve with a lot of airport travelers. There's something about those x-ray machines where the concerns about x-ray and also the fact that they give a naked body image have, again, struck a raw nerve. It seems as though what you went through has touched a lot of people who have some degree of concerns that are similar.
There was only one really mean message on my machine.
How many messages have you had on your machine?
I don't know, hundreds of them, and I just erased them all. But the one message was from a woman in Inglewood. She said, hi, groper, I can set up a legal fund for you, or something like that. It was the way she called me out, I just felt denigrated. Just making fun of me. I have been falsely accused and I have been framed in a certain way from media so that it can be a catchy thing. But in that frame, who I am and my dignity are sacrificed.
It takes a lot of creativity for someone to take an idea and make it be a quick headline to highlight the issue of the fact that a lot of airline travelers are afraid to travel right now and intimidated by what going through security is like. Do you suppose there are any of them out there who can somehow use that creativity to tell more of this other side of the story?
I hope so. I grew up in Japan, listening to Voice of America, I was educated on aspiration for democracy. I was growing up learning about Bill of Rights and women's movements, labor movement in the United States. I dreamed of America as wonderful, wonderful country. As a child, I really wanted to wear blue jeans. At the time, it was very expensive, but for me, the blue jean symbolized good, decent, hardworking people who believe in justice, liberty, and freedom. Is it really all right for America to become this, like this?
You mean, is it all right to, in the interest of safety, have a security system going through airports that makes travelers sometimes feel very unsafe? You said that when you go through the Phoenix airport, when you don't want to go through the X-ray gate, they say, nope, you can't go through the metal detector gate and you need to be patted down. How about at Denver International Airport?
I was patted down last week.
At Denver International Airport?
Yes. I was traumatized by it, and then I was crying and screaming. The agent said, next time you go to this particular gate, it is the metal detector gate, and you will not get pat down because they will examine the luggage and everything much more carefully. It takes long time to pass through. But if you have small children, or if you have medical issues, or if you have some kind of emotional trauma about being touched, you can choose to go through it. So it's very informative.
This was the Transportation Safety Administration staff person who recognized that you were intimidated and traumatized by being touched and gave you this other option, which is there as part of the procedures at Denver International Airport now, that it may take longer to go through the line, but you have a line that you can go through where you can feel safer.
It's a decent, intelligent way of dealing with the real issue.
How did you feel where you were upset it was not again, I'm going to be patted down again, so you were crying and even screaming? That must have been disruptive in the airport.
They put you in a pat-down away from people. But I'm sure that must have been very difficult for the agent. And then she said, you know, you have to be watch out because in Arizona, in Phoenix, there is a woman who was arrested. And I said to her, that was me. And she said, you? There was a conversation. There is a, you know, attempt to relate to me as a person. You know, that is so much different from treated as thing or animal.
And somehow she made the distinction between you being upset because maybe you're hiding a terrible weapon and you're going to kill her at any moment. And the fact that you were scared and upset that once again you were feeling helpless. And she gave you another option.
I applaud Denver International Airport.
And how about her? How about this TSA agent?
I'm very, very appreciative of her. She's an intelligent person to be able to recognize the situation and the kindness to my experience.
How has that helped for you going through the airport now that you know that at least at one airport there's an option?
I'm so lucky that I live in Colorado. That's what I thought. There's an airport that I would not want to go. Currently, it's Phoenix, Arizona. But I do hope they actually learn from this media craziness. Airport security is everybody's concern. We want to have effective, truly secure airport security. We want that. We all want that. But we also want all our citizens to feel safe in their own body.
Yukari Miyamai, thank you for sharing your story.
Thank you for listening to me.
I'm Shelley Schlender. For listeners with concerns about passenger screening methods, Yukari recommends the National Association of Airline Passengers. Their website is righttofly.net. That's right, the number two, then fly.net.
And once again, thanks to KG News, Yukari Miyamai, and Shelley Schlender for talking about Yukari's experience of being arrested in the Phoenix airport. Once again, that website is right, R-I-G-H-T, the number two, and then F-L-Y dot net. Tune in tomorrow when KG News' Maeve Conran will interview the head of Right to Fly, Douglas Kidd. Time now for the Morning Sound Alternative.